The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. An old cliche, you and your enemy share your foods and understanding breaks through like the rays of the sun. But it doesn't usually work that way. Except when it does, and it did for chefs Sammy Tamimi and Yotam Ottolenghi. Their cookbooks are bestsellers. Jerusalem and now Ottolenghi are beautifully published with gorgeous photos and exotic flavors. But these two authors have an unusual story. Both grew up in Jerusalem. Yotam in the Jewish West, Sammy in the Muslim East. Different worlds, yet shared tastes and sensibilities from their childhoods brought them together. Stay with us. Lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Yotam Ottolenghi and Sammy Tamimi lit up the food world with their sexy, delicious takes on the sometimes controversial flavors of their childhood. They grew up in Jerusalem, a few miles from each other, but politically worlds apart. Yotam in Jewish West Jerusalem and Sammy in the Muslim East. But their paths crossed in London, where Yotam owns the restaurant group Ottolenghi. Sammy is the head chef and partner, and together they co-author the best-selling Jerusalem and now their recently released Ottolenghi. Add to this duo Joan Nathan, the Jewish food scholar and author of numerous books on Jewish foodways. Now, she loves Jerusalem. She lived there for many years while working for the legendary mayor, Teddy Kollek. Well, we put these three together in Washington, D.C.
Yotam, Sammy, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Joan. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello.
Well, I just wanted to tell you that I'm just back from Jerusalem. I was there like 2 days ago. And I thought of the two of you growing up in that city. What was the city like to grow up in? Sammy, do you want to start? You lived in the old city, correct?
Yeah, it was a kind of protective life. We lived in a big house in the old city with a view of the mosques.
And beautiful.
Yeah, it was a very traditional house, but kind of open house and quite liberal.
Did your mother go to the markets?
My father used to buy most of the ingredients for the cooking because he had connections and people kind of liked him. And I used to go even to buy coffee, and I used to just say my father's name, and they'll have this special blend that he actually decided this is the way he liked the coffee.
I think your father, like from all the stuff that I hear, he was quite a personality. He was a big personality.
Yeah, a bit like me.
Yeah. He was a bit like you, right? But he lived in the Muslim quarter.
Yeah, my grandma had a house that was very close to the Jewish quarter.
In the old city.
Yeah, and I remember her saying that, you know, when she moved there, newly wedded, they had actually Jewish neighbors. And they lived, yeah, and they lived in peace.
Well, I think probably it was before 48, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. And then the family grown, and they had to move to a bigger house, so they moved to the Muslim quarter, and they lost all the connections in the old house.
But they probably traded recipes in the old house.
I'm sure they did.
I'm sure they did. Yeah, no, because when we wrote the book, we found doing all sorts of investigations and talking to people and reading books that it just there was so much interaction that you couldn't tell whether something was Sephardic or Palestinian, because, you know, they were there for, you know, 500 years or however long in the old city, living side by side with the Muslims and cooking the same food. It wasn't even borrowing. It was just the culinary culture.
So, Yotam, what was it like in West Jerusalem?
Huh. West
Jerusalem.
Yeah, West Jerusalem was different. I don't think I had an exotic upbringing as Sammy's. I'm afraid it was much more mundane. But
when they wanted the exotics, they used to come to our side.
It's true. Or to go to Jericho or, you know, anywhere in there. And actually, on a more serious level, that is true, because Sammy and I were both born in 1968, which is just after the Six-Day War, where Jerusalem was, when Israel took on the East Jerusalem, and it was all a very new world for us. You know, in the 70s, Jerusalem, the West, the Jewish side, and the East, the Arab side, were still kind of, they didn't know what brought them together. You know, there was a slight naivety in the air, and people kind of felt, and I'm sure, Joan, you remember it because you lived in Jerusalem at the time, mm-hmm. that it might still work out somehow. Now Absolutely. It doesn't feel like that anymore, but you know, you would go to
there
the old...
There was a sense of hope then.
Yeah, there was a sense of hope, and people didn't know what it means yet, what are going to be the consequences of this massive change, and mm-hmm. they haven't been too good. But at that point, you know, I think there was quite a lot of interaction. We used to go to, you know, a kebab place or a bakery in the old city and sit there, and there was no sense of any kind of, we didn't dread or fear or anything.
Well, at that time, you know, when I guess 20 years later after you were born, you were young, you were gay, you needed freedom to become you.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to go back to Jerusalem?
After more than 20 years, Jerusalem is a tough place to grow up in. So you develop all sorts of, I think, mechanisms to kind of deal with it. And, because there's a lot of pressure in Jerusalem. You know, there's a lot of God around. And God
on
is...
all sides.
On all sides. And so it's not easy. So I don't think it's a peaceful upbringing, you know, growing up. There's a lot of wonderful things going on. There's amazing food. There's a lot of liveliness. And that's all great. But there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of stuff in the air.
It feels so very heavy for kids to be there.
Completely. And to go back is just going a little bit going back in time. It's kind of, it sits on your shoulders a little bit to go back.
I mean, you feel like it's a place that's stuck in time, although the face of the city changed a lot. A lot of what's happening in Jerusalem, it's behind doors.
Yeah.
So let's get to your restaurants. Mm-hmm. I've never been to your restaurants. And
you're saying that on public radio, right?
On public radio. I'm going. I told you I'm going in a few months.
Okay.
What's it like to eat at Ottolenghi, Yotam?
You walk into an Ottolenghi and there is a kind of a celebration of food all around you. There is Sammy and I go to great lengths to make the display look fantastic. So big platters of food,
I've
mainly vegetables,
those.
All piled up with lots of colors. The platters themselves are quite beautiful, and the whole display is kind of it shouts, you know, abundance and beauty and color. And then opposite you'd find, or after it you'd find a pastry display with a kind of a similar mirrored image. Again, lots of cakes, a lot of little cakes like in rows, you know, financiers or semolina cakes or orange cakes, tarts, meringues. And we also tend to store our produce in the shop. So as you walk in, you see both the cooked food and the ingredients we use.
And so how did you meet there? Or
We met in London. I used to work in a place called Baker and Spice, and Yotam came to apply for a job, and then we started working together in separate sections.
Sammy gave me my job, I think, more or less, because I came in because I loved the look of the place. It had a very kind of unique look, and everything looked very artisanal mm-hmm. and delicious. Obviously, because Sammy cooked it, and
of course,
and I walked in, and his work counter was at the back of the shop, so he was the first person that I had seen. I said to him if I can apply for a job, and he said, "Well, the manager's not here. Give me your CV." I gave him my CV, and then we just started talking, and through this conversation, we got to know each other, and we realized actually that we've got so much in common, you know, that we grew up in the same city, we were born in the same year.
So you're speaking
year.
Hebrew together.
We speak Hebrew together.
We started in English and then we right. switched to Hebrew.
Now we speak mostly Hebrew and sometimes English. It depends mm-hmm. what we start the day with or the conversation.
So as I was leafing through Ottolenghi, which I have to tell you, I love this book. The first recipe I went to was Musachan, and I noticed you changed it from the way your mother made it.
Yeah.
And Musachan is my favorite chicken dish in the entire world.
It is just the best dish in the entire world. That's why.
Do you think that too?
Yeah.
One of them.
I knew there was a reason I liked the two of you. So do you want to explain what it was and how you changed it from your mom's recipe?
Musachan is essentially, for people that don't
know, it's a roast chicken with spices and pine nuts and onion and lots of sumac and za'atar. And they serve it on a bed of
pita, so right. the pita basically soaks all the flavor of the chicken.
I think the best thing about Arab food is when juices from roasted meats, whether it's lamb or chicken, it's the best thing you can have. It's like the best of everything. It's the meat, it's the rice, and then the bread that soaks it. It's just heavenly.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for being such amazing culinary ambassadors.
Thanks, Joan.
And I hope you open a restaurant in the United States. Thank you.
One day, perhaps. Thank you for having us.
It's a big pleasure. Thank you.
Yotam Ottolenghi and Sammy Tamimi are authors of Ottolenghi, the Cookbook. Joan Nathan's latest book will be out in the spring, King Solomon's Table. Find that recipe for roast chicken with sumac, za'atar, and lemon, moussakan, on the website. Now, also, be sure to get registered for our latest giveaway. It's a 10-piece set of Ballerini nonstick cookware from Italy. And 14 of you could take that set home. All the info is at splendidtable.org. In these days of Brit obsession fueled by the drama in Downton Abbey, it may be time to look behind the scenes of another English household, that of Queen Victoria. This woman ruled for 63 years. Now, we know a lot about her life, from the evolution of the girl to queen to grieving widow. Now we have a look inside the royal household and what mealtime was like for the queen. Contributor David Leet talked to Kate Hubbard, author of Serving Victoria, Life in the Royal Household.
Kate, it's nice to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
So, Kate, tell us, what kind of eater was Queen Victoria?
Well, I think she both ate a great deal, but she also ate extremely fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, she loved her food. She was greedy.
Greedy.
And she gobbled. And she liked her dinners to last no more than half an hour. So guests would quite often find their plates kind of whisked away while they were still eating because once she had finished, all the plates were removed. So she was a hearty eater and she was a fast eater.
Interesting. So basically, if someone was not done, they were done when the queen was finished.
Yes, they were. Yeah, your time was up.
Can you describe a little bit about some of the meals that she had, the breakfasts, the lunch, the dinners, where she had them, who she had them with?
Yes. Her breakfast she would have taken on her own. She had a private dining room close mm-hmm. to her bedroom. And when Albert was alive, she would have eaten her breakfast with Albert and probably, no, maybe one of her children, but probably not, probably just with Albert. She had a lot of sort of, she tended to have a very kind of protein-rich breakfast, tongue and fowl, as they called it, chicken, mm-hmm. kidneys maybe, bacon and eggs, that kind of thing. Then lunch, which would have been around 2 o'clock, again, she would have had with her family, with Albert, maybe with her children, but not with her ladies and gentlemen. Mm-hmm. And again, that tended to be also, it was very meat heavy in general, their diet. So she often had roast fowl, roast chicken.
And what was this fascination with protein back then? Was it just what everyone was doing or was it strictly a court dish?
No, I don't think it was strictly a court dish. I think the Victorians in general ate a lot of meat. Mm-hmm. And they did have vegetables. They had seasonal vegetables, so they ate things like asparagus, spinach, sea kale. Mm-hmm. But it was very heavy on meat. But I think that was a general thing about Victorian England. Mm-hmm. Then she would have had a large tea. And then dinner was around sort of 8:30, 9 o'clock. And that was much more elaborate. And she would have eaten that in the sort of the big, it was known as the large dining room mm-hmm. At Windsor Castle, and which was a much more grand and stately, more formal room. And she would have then had members of her household, so her ladies and her gentlemen. Often there would have been some guests, maybe some visiting royalties from abroad, some of her children when they were adults. And that was a kind of a much more elaborate sort of, you know, many courses, a soup, then a fish, then a meat, then a dessert. And then there would have been a side table, mm-hmm. Which they called a buffet. And on the side table, there was a whole array of meats like venison and brawn, marrow bone, maybe a kind of great large piece of beef. So I guess I think the idea was if you were still feeling a little peckish, you could fill up and have a bit of extra meat.
So how courtly was the conversation at the table when Victoria was eating?
Well, in fact, the Queen, she tended to stick to platitudes, although she liked, she was interested in gossip in private. But around the table, she tended to stick to platitudes, and she very much discouraged any controversial topics. So politics, for example, they could not be discussed. And she tended, if someone strayed onto a slightly dangerous topic, she would steer the conversation swiftly back. There were other things, like she didn't like marriage being discussed in front of her youngest daughter, Beatrice, before Beatrice married. So anyone who mentioned marriage at dinner was swiftly reprimanded.
Well, that's very interesting. Kate, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Kate Hubbard is author of Serving Victoria, Life in the Royal Household. David Leet's forthcoming book is Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression. Coming up, fresh inspiration for holiday giving from the improvised life Sally Schneider and Single Flower Honey, anybody? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. As anxiety about gift giving begins to throttle up, we're here to say do not despair, for we have help for those cooks and eaters on your list. Our contributor, Melissa Clarks, turned to Sally Schneider of The Improvised Life for some help.
Hi, Sally. So great to have you.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm so glad to be here.
So please, help me out for the holidays. I have a long list of foodie gifts that I need to buy or to make, and I know that this is right up your alley.
It is up my alley. I've been thinking about this for a long time and testing them out. First of all, I look for gifts that can be given any time for any occasion. Mm-hmm. So we're not just bound to the holidays. If you're going to a dinner party or whatever, you can stockpile these. I start with inexpensive bought ones that I can keep on hand. My favorite being markers for wine glasses that I give with a bottle of wine when I go to a dinner.
That is great, because I think that's most people's go-to gift. And in this way, you're personalizing it. So what do the markers do?
Well, first of all, I learned this from Anthony Giglio, who's a wine writer. I went to his house one night, and he handed me a glass of wine that had my name on it.
Written on the glass.
Yes. And the reason for this is, commonly, at fairly big parties or at any dinner party, people forget which glass is theirs.
I lose my wine glass all the time.
Yeah.
But how do you write it on the glass?
There are a couple of kinds of markers you can use. One is a Faino China marker, which is really one of those old-fashioned wax pencils that has a little string you pull to sharpen it.
Yep, those are great.
And the reason those are nice is because you can just put the glass in the dishwasher and it'll take off the mark.
Oh, that's great.
Now, I've done some further tests and found out that Sharpies and the washable markers used on whiteboards also work really well.
That is a great gift for people, especially with the wine or maybe even with a couple of nice wine glasses if you found some that
yes.
you really liked.
Yes.
What other kinds of things can I stockpile? I love the idea of stockpiling gifts, and that way you always have them on hand.
Well, I actually just ordered some of my very favorite paring knives, which are not the expensive black-handled chef's knives.
Mm-hmm.
These are made by an old French company called L'Econome. They're really charming. They have colored wood handles. They feel good in the hand. They sharpen easily on a steel. And they cost about $10 each.
Oh, that's great.
Cooks with everything love them, and novice cooks love them.
Now, I was looking on your website recently. By the way, I love your website.
And
you have this wonderful idea about vintage fondue forks, which I think is fabulous. Tell us about that.
Well, I realized that the tool that I use every day is a vintage fondue fork from the 50s, which is about 11 inches long, very long and sleek, with three tines, with a, like a regular fork, and
okay,
a wood
handle.
Okay,
so not the kind with two.
No, you don't want the spear-like ones. And I find not only do I use it to pull things out of a pan or out of the broiler or whip up eggs, but I find myself using them for my private dinners. It makes my salad taste better to eat with them.
With a very long, elegant fork. I bet yes. They're great for getting things out of jars. That was the first thing I thought of is, oh, I can get that last little anchovy right out of the jar with
that's,
this long.
That's right. And you can also use them for serving because a lot of them are really kind of sculptural and beautiful.
Where do you find them?
I troll eBay. Uh-huh. There are tons of them. Apparently, everybody was eating fondue in the 50s. And they come in different styles. But for an example of the cost, I just bought six for $20.
Oh, that's great.
So a $3.50 fondue fork with a little note and a message about what it's for is a fabulous gift.
What about gifts that you can make?
Those actually are some of the most coveted gifts, I find, because they're one-offs, and you've taken your time to make them,
yeah.
So they're a great treasure. I like to just take plain old wooden spoons, which you can buy easily, and paint the handles.
Oh.
You can mask them off with masking tape and use artist acrylic paint, which lasts longer than a water-based house paint, and make stripes or different patterns, or just simply dip the handle into paint.
So I need to look for acrylic paint that will last longer than water-based paint.
Yes.
Another great thing that I saw on your site, and I just love this idea, beeswax sheets. Tell me about what those are and how I would use it.
These are cotton squares or rectangles that have been infused with beeswax and propolis and a couple of other things. You can buy them online from Abigo or Beeswraps. There mm-hmm. are a couple of companies making them, and they are an alternative to plastic wrap. Now, everyone I know is trying to get away from plastic wrap, but then relies on it because there's nothing really that works in its place.
So you'd use it, you'd take this sheet of beeswax cloth and then you'd put it over a bowl, or
yes.
you'd wrap cheese in it?
It's firm to start, and just from the touch of your hands, it gets malleable.
Okay.
So you can cover a bowl with it, you can wrap cheese, you can wrap salamis, all kinds of things.
And the beeswax doesn't flake off?
No, it doesn't. It molds. And you wash it in cold water with soap, and I have heard, last about a year.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And can you make them yourself as well?
You can indeed.
Instructions are on your website?
Yes.
I'm going to check that out.
What I do recommend is when you give these, in the note, include how to wash them and handle them and so on, because they're a new thing for people.
Yeah, I've never seen them except on your website, and I'm really excited about trying them. What about something for someone on a really tight budget?
Okay. Years ago, a friend of mine started giving me a sheaf of writing or poems about food every year. And all she did was find something wonderful from M.F.K. Fisher or Haiku or Pablo Neruda, any evocative, beautiful piece about food. And she would print it out on a computer printer on wonderful paper.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd put together 10 or 12 of them, roll them into a roll bound with ribbon, and give it to me.
Oh, that's so nice.
And in the weeks that follow, every morning I would sit down and read one of those pieces. And I can't tell you how much it's meant to me.
You could do the same thing with recipes. Collect your favorite recipes for your friends.
Yes.
Or maybe even give that beautiful sheaf of nice paper with the recipes and then an ingredient.
Really good idea.
Yep. Sally, thank you so much, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Melissa.
Sally Schneider is the mind behind The Improvised Life. You can find her picks for the cook in your life, as well as her ideas for more homemade gifts, on their website, splendidtable.org. Melissa Clark's new book is Dinner Changing the Game. Try her shrimp scampi with Pernod and fennel fronds. You know where it is. It's at splendidtable.org. Star thistle, buckwheat, blueberry. These are honey varietals. Yes, individual honeys from those particular plants. And would you believe that they're becoming as popular as single bean chocolates? Okay, so how do you choose one? Well, evidently, you need to know a bit about the honey's origins, exactly where it came from. Marina Marchese joins us. Now, she's the author of The Honey Connoisseur. Marina, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Lynn.
So what is the difference between what is in that honey bear and the jars in the supermarket and the honeys that say that they're from a specific flower or are have the name of a beekeeper on them?
So you're talking about single origin nectar, which is honey that is harvested from a single floral source. You're familiar with clover and orange blossom honey, or possibly blueberry blossom honey. Now, when we talk about commercial honey, we don't always know what's in there. We don't always know exactly the process that the honey has gone through from the beehive to the bottle. We're finding out that some of this honey might not be 100% pure liquid gold.
Well, what would it be then?
Well, there's been incidents of blending and filtering. They've found different kinds of sugars have been added occasionally, high fructose corn syrup.
Is this related at all to the loss of bees that we've been hearing about?
I think indirectly it is. You know, the demand for honey is so high in this country, and what we produce is very little compared to the demand. So some of the producers on a larger scale are actually importing honey and doing different things to extend the product to meet the demand.
Now, okay, so if I add a little bit of sugar syrup or high fructose corn syrup or glucose or whatever to the honey, is that a terrible thing?
Well, you shouldn't really be labeling it honey. It should be maybe honey blend. If you're going to be heating it or pasteurizing it, you're going to compromise some of the delicate flavors. The color can be changed by heating. The enzymes and the healthy benefits of honey can be compromised. So honey is a very fragile product. It's raw. And when it comes out of the beehive, it has amazing healing properties. And it also has an amazing flavor that you will lose by processing.
So what is on the label that we need to know about?
Well, you really want to look for the name of the beekeeper, or you want to know the apiary or the region it was harvested. There's not a lot of regulation in labeling. So today when we look at honey, a lot of the times on the label we're seeing distributed by a larger company. And we're also seeing that sometimes if there's honesty, they're telling us where the commercial honey is from, different countries like China, could be Mexico, Canada. So they're taking this honey from all different places and they're blending it together so that you have this product that is always a medium amber. It's fairly transparent and the flavor profile is consistent every time you get that little plastic bear or if you, you know, a jar
whatever,
of honey.
Right.
So, but honey is an agricultural product. It should never be the same. Every harvest will be different depending upon the floral source and the seasonality of it and the location or the terroir.
You do honey tastings. How do we taste honey?
Well, we like to start out by observing the color of the honey. Like I said, the commercially made honey sometimes are transparent and most honey has pollen in it. So you're going to get a honey that is pretty cloudy. It should never really be totally transparent, although there are a few honeys that are.
Uh-huh.
But generally, honey should be have some pollen in it, and it should look a little bit cloudy. And the same way you would taste wine or chocolate or cheeses, you would smell it, take a big whiff.
Right.
And you'll get some aromas of beeswax. Sometimes you'll get some pollen. You'll get definitely the different flavors of the honey depending upon the plant source. And then when you taste honey, we like to put it on our tongue, let it melt, get to body temperature, and then just really pay attention and concentrate on the flavors that you're getting. You know, honey isn't just sweet. It has layers of flavor. And it's amazing when you taste different honey side by side, you can really taste the difference between that different floral source.
Marina, so interesting. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marina Marchese is the author of The Honey Connoisseur, and you can find her dynamite recipe for honey-struck chocolate truffles on the website, splendidtable.org. Crunching down on fried chicken, you know, the kind that dreams are made of, spooning up cheesy grits, eating glorious barbecue and collard greens. Well, we call it soul food, and according to Adrian Miller, it's slipping away, and we don't actually know what soul food is about. Well, this attorney who worked in the Clinton White House on the Initiative for Race and then went on to join think tanks turned its curiosity to the food of his heritage, the food he believes we don't understand. And he's written Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. Adrian, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to break cornbread. Appreciate you having me on your show.
It's a lovely thought. So how do you define soul food?
Well, I take it in layers. So the first cut is soul food is one of the traditional foods of African Americans, because African Americans have made significant contributions to some other well-known cuisines, like the cooking of the Low Country of the Carolinas and Georgia and Creole cuisine of the New Orleans area. But it's really the food of the migrants who left the Deep South and went to other parts of the country and did what other migrants do. They tried to recreate home through their food, and to the best they could, they brought the ingredients with them, and if they couldn't, they substituted them. And so it becomes the national cuisine of African Americans.
So, but the cuisine that African Americans have eaten traditionally in the South is a much broader base, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of overlap between Southern food and soul food. And I think soul food is a limited repertoire of Southern food, because the South just has so many different cuisines within it. But there are a lot of common ingredients: black-eyed peas, greens, rice, beans, fried chicken, catfish. You know, there's a lot of overlap.
Right. Well, you picked in this book, the way you laid out this book is you actually had a menu, and in each chapter you talked about a particular food and its history. And so which foods did you pick, and why did you pick them?
Yeah, so the meal I put together was fried chicken, fried catfish, or chitlins as the entrees. And I couldn't write a book about soul food without writing about chitlins. And then the sides are greens, black-eyed peas, mac and cheese, candied yams. I also write a chapter about cornbread and then hot sauce, because that's the soul food condiment of choice.
Right.
And then I include a chapter on red drinks, because I think red Kool-Aid is the official soul food drink. And yes, red is a flavor. You should know that. And then for the desserts, I put together four that I think are the most popular. So that's sweet potato pie, pound cake, banana pudding, and peach cobbler.
Why chitlins? Now, maybe you should describe them, because some people are unfamiliar with them.
Oh, okay. So chitlins are pig's intestines, and they're either eaten, they're either prepared by stewing or by frying. I've never had them fried. I've always had them stewed, and that seems to be the more traditional soul food.
Are they stuffed then, like a sausage?
No. So you clean them out, and then you just kind of cut it up a little bit, and then you just put it in the pot with some seasoning. I put in red pepper and onion and garlic.
Now, there's a religious connection with eating that.
Yeah, so this was one of the surprising things to me. So in a lot of traditional cultures, you know, the innards of animals are considered sacred because they hold the life force of the animal. So even in West Africa and some Yoruba societies, they view the intestines that way. So even though they didn't have pigs, you can see that kind of cultural legacy coming across the Atlantic and taking root in the Americas using just different animals.
Because the image of a lot of soul food is this is what the white man didn't want to eat. And, you know, this is then what went to the slaves. But it sounds like this was a desirable food. It wasn't a case that it was, you know, the discards of the white man, so we have to eat it.
Right, because chitlins, I mean, intestines were actually an aristocratic dish in England and France well back into the Middle Ages, mainly coming out of deer hunting. And so, yeah, that was one of the biggest surprises for me, is how chitlins had this kind of high-class pedigree. But the dirty little secret of Southern food and soul food is that in most cases, whites and blacks were eating the same foods, and it really depended on your socioeconomic status rather than race.
So when did Southern food eaten by black people become soul food, and why?
So it really starts to happen with the Great Migrations that started in 1910s and goes through the 1970s. And a lot of this was spurred by economic opportunity created by World War I and other things. And so you have millions of African Americans leaving the South and going to other places. And so the food in those other places was started to be called down-home cooking, and that's the precursor to soul food. Now, the common explanation is that soul food as a coin term comes in the 1960s with the Black Power movement.
Right.
But it was floating around in the English language long before that. I mean, it had a religious connotation for centuries, and it was anything that would edify your spiritual life. So listening to a sermon, reading scriptures, all of that stuff was considered soul food. And then it was really in the 1940s that you start to see it have a cultural spin. And that's really much due to the jazz musicians who wanted to take their music to a place where they thought white artists couldn't mimic it. And that was the sounds of the rural church in the American South. And so those sounds, that gospel sound, was called funky and soul in its earlier iterations, and then soul is the one that cut on. So we could easily be calling this cuisine funky food, but that's not very appetizing.
That's true. But it did become much more a term that was coined and used constantly during the Black Power movement in the 60s and then into the 70s.
Right. So the interesting thing is that, you know, Southern and soul were pretty synonymous for a long time and a shared cuisine. And then in the 60s, you had some activists say, no, 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 there's really a separation here. And that white Southerners really can't understand soul food, can't understand ham hocks, greens, and chitlins, and those sort of things. And that was news to white Southerners. So that's where you start to see a split there between soul and Southern. And soul gets associated with African Americans, while Southern gets associated with whites, even though there's a lot of overlap.
Interesting. Really fascinating. Adrian, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Adrian Miller is author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. Well, make yourself up a bunch of citrus collards with raisins from Chef Bryant Terry's book, Vegan Soul Kitchen. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Well, we'll be back in a moment to take your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time to connect with you. We're taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. And remember, there's Facebook, Twitter, and email. Go to splendidtable.org. Andrea's on the phone from St. Louis. Andrea, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I have a truffle question.
A truffle question. Now, is this something you're digging out of the ground or something you're making with chocolate?
We'll need hogs for this one. Right out of the ground.
You're kidding.
Wants truffles for Christmas.
You mean as in, oh boy, the diamonds of the earth.
Exactly.
Oh, brother. Bring a lot of money, girl.
Well, they're mighty expensive. I'm just a working girl, Lynn. Can't really afford it. So I was wondering what product you thought gives the best taste of truffles.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess really the best taste is going to come from truffle oil.
Yeah.
And when it comes to brands, this is where we get stymied because now I tend to lean toward the Italian truffles as opposed to the black truffles. The Italian truffles have a distinctive flavor of garlic and earth.
Okay.
And Urbani, U-R-B-A-N-I, and I'm not even sure if they make oil. See, I have a confession to make, Andrea. Yes. Most truffle oils to me are a waste of time.
I know. I've had the same experience.
You too? I mean, most of them just stink. And they're a waste of time, and I haven't done much of a survey on them. Urbani imports white truffles from Italy, and they usually do a very, very good job. If anyone's going to make a decent truffle oil, they're probably the company that does, but I don't know if they do.
Okay. Have you ever tried any of the paste? Or they have, like, sliced truffles in liquid sometimes I've seen as a product?
Yeah, I have too, and this is where my annoyance with low-grade tastes that I've had has said I'm not going to waste my time and my money.
Okay.
And my cynicism has worked against my being able to help you, and I feel very, very badly about this.
This is a great recommendation, Urbani. I've heard of them as a brand. So
well, they have always in the past, they have delivered very respectable truffles. But what I would do is I would go to the websites of major magazines and to the New York Times.
Okay.
And to the LA Times. And to the Washington Post. These are all websites of entities that are going to be very critical.
Okay.
Okay.
check them out because these are the ones you're going to be able to trust.
I will. Thank you, Lynn.
All right. Sorry I couldn't be of more help.
No, thanks for the recommendation.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252 is one way to connect with us. Facebook and Twitter are two other ways. And then the third way is email at splendidtable.org. Kasha is calling from Washington, D.C. Kasha, what can I do for you?
Okay, so thank you very much for taking my call. It's really exciting. We get those fantastic vegetables from our lovely little Carl Farm CSA, and every week for the last 3 weeks, I guess, we get those giant mustard greens.
And oh, yes.
They're lovely. They're huge, delicious, but they are so spicy when raw. They're like this horseradish. When they cooked, they're so bitter that I just cannot find a better way.
So maybe
you could recommend something because I tried to saute them, roast them, cook in coconut milk. And last time I prepared this lovely quiche. That was actually the best way.
You know why? Did the quiche have eggs and cream in it?
Yes.
Okay. What happens is the bitterness is, if I recall, and the scientists in the audience are going to probably raise their eyes to heaven, but it's the alkaloid in the green. And there are a couple of ways to approach this because mustard greens are just great. Number one, start mixing them with other greens. So in so many words, if you do two parts chard, which is really sweet, with one part mustard green, and you pre-steam the mustard green and save the water because it's, you know, you can use that when you make soup or just as a what I try to do is I save the water and I keep steaming over the same water and that ends up being a broth.
Oh, great idea.
Yeah. So, you know, it'll taste a little bit of carrot. It'll taste a little bit of broccoli or whatever. But that aside, okay, so pre-cook them because that's going to tame them down a bit. Don't boil them. You'll lose all the nutrients.
Sure.
But mix them up with sweet greens. The other thing you can do is exactly what you did, which is look to dairy for them. Now, I'll give you an instance.
Okay.
If you were to do a spicy yogurt combination, you know, yogurt with roasted and then, you know, ground in a coffee grinder, coriander, a little bit of cardamom. That kind of thing. Look to Morocco and look to India, you know, for seasonings. But if we were going to go Morocco, we would do cumin, we would do coriander, whole, and then you grind them. A bit of cinnamon, probably a bit of sweet paprika and a little bit of hot paprika. And you want to mix that in. Warm them first. Mix them into the yogurt, maybe with garlic if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And then cook your greens. Saute them or do whatever you want with them. I'd steam them, okay?
Okay.
Season them however you want. But serve them topped with that yogurt combination.
Wow.
That would be fantastic. You could use low fat. Don't use no fat. You could use low fat or you could use full fat yogurt. And if
I prefer full fat yogurt.
I do too. I mean, there's nothing like it. But that's the idea right there.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you very much for your help.
Thank you. It's a great question. I think a lot of people run into problems with mustard greens.
I guess so.
You take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Communicate with us on Facebook and Twitter, or actually call us, 800-537-5252. And that's what Glenda did. She's calling from Eagle Point, Oregon. So, Glenda, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about making mozzarella cheese at home.
This is worth the effort. So tell me, where are you in this process?
Well, I've made it probably 8 times now. And the interesting thing is it seems to come out a little different each time. The other day I made 4 batches in one day. Each one came out a little bit differently. And it came out from being, you know, wonderful, having the nice, shiny, elastic, you know, feel to it, to actually ending up having to be scooped into a container, and it looked like ricotta cheese.
How did it taste?
It was delicious. Even the mistakes are delicious.
Right, exactly.
And usable, absolutely. But I'm wondering, maybe I stir, sometimes I stir it too much. I think I'm doing it the same each time. But sometimes after I let it sit for 5 minutes untouched, like we're supposed to, after it's been heated, the results vary from being very set to just being little small particles of curds that float around separately in the whey.
Okay, now let me ask you something. Are you actually starting the process with milk and acid and making the cheese? Are you starting with curds that you then warm and stretch?
I'm starting with the milk and the citric acid powder and a little bit of a vegetable rennet tablet.
Okay. All right. So it's classic cheese making, kind of 101.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the key. The slower that you heat milk to have it separate, okay, the softer and gentler the curd. The other thing is that you generally don't want to go beyond about 180 degrees. So if what's maybe happening is, especially if you're doing multiple batches, is that some of that curd that remains very soft needs to be a bit warmer. So do you keep a check on water temperature?
Well, I do, yeah, because it's first you bring it to 90 degrees, and then you remove it from the heat, you pour in the rennet, you stir it up a little bit, you let it sit, and then you heat it up to 105 degrees.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Okay. At 105 is when the curd comes together?
Right. 105 okay. degrees is when you use the slotted spoon to transfer the curds into a colander to start getting rid of liquid.
Right. And then it goes back into the water to be stretched?
Well, you stretch it. The recipes that I've found have me putting it in and out of the microwave 3 different times.
Ah, I've never tried that technique. I've watched it being made in Italy and made it myself a few times. And the technique that I use, and it makes sense, the microwave may make sense, but what you do is you have this water that is kept below boiling. And what you're doing is, as that curd forms, you scoop it out, you let it drain, you try to get rid of much of the moisture in it, but not all. And then you put it back in and you take a wooden spoon or whatever and you stretch it gently, just like taffy. You know, in the water, pulling it out of the water, letting it stretch, letting it drop back, pulling it out. And you do that briefly. And when you get a texture where it still has some softness, because a great mozzarella has a softer center. It's not solid. It has just a milky, milky quality to it. And I'm not saying it's running in the center, but it's softer. So you don't want to ever, heat it too fast, and you don't want to do anything to toughen it. So then what you've done after you've done several stretches, maybe 3 or 4, right? And it looks like taffy. What you do then is you start to shape it. So you may do it in knots, you may do it whatever, and you drop that into water. In fact, it may even be water that has a teeny bit of whey in it. But you drop that into the water, and that's where it stays. I've never tried the microwave, but I think what's probably happening is that the density of the cheese, what happens with the microwave or with the temperature, and what all that affects how that mozzarella is going to be in terms of texture. So if you've got a lump of cheese, you know, it's going to take longer for the temperature to reach the center than if you've got a long strand of it or a cord of it.
Oh, this sounds much better than, in the microwave.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, and I'd say just take a look. And also, if you go online, that you can find some really interesting artisans doing this kind of thing. Because if a microwave works, for goodness sakes, use it. But it's an amazingly simple thing to make. And like anything simple, so much can get confusing.
Yeah. But I like it. Thank you.
You are welcome. Hey, Glenda, really, thanks, though, for a great question, because making it, I'd love to have everybody making their own mozzarella.
Oh, well, you know what we're doing now is my friends next door have a smoker. I'm just the first step. The second step is I give it to them, and they're smoking it.
Oh, brother. Next step is somebody on the other side is going to get a cow. You have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye.
I appreciate your time. Bye-bye.
Making your own mozzarella can be very, very easy, but it's a really gentle process. It's great fun. I'm making your own fresh cheese. Ah, fabulous. Cream cheese, ricotta. Easy. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Julia Child. She said, the only time to eat diet food is while you're waiting for the steak to cook. SplendidTable.org has just about everything you will ever need. Recipes, extended interviews, and you can register for our giveaways and our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And if you like what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.